Hello, human peoples. You're listening to the podcast network of Gamefully Unemployed. Support us and gain access to great exclusive podcasts like Fox Mulder is a Maniac, Tom and Jeff Watch Batman, Star Trek The Next Futurama, and our latest show, Spiel Boys. Head over to patreon.com/gamefullyunemployed. We do game streaming, movie nights with our patrons every Friday night, and you can even commission your own podcast about anything you want. Literally anything, within reason, and we have to do it. You are quite frankly out of excuses not to go visit patreon.com/gamefullyunemployed. That's patreon.com/gamefully unemployed, which is spelled like it sounds.
What fun. What a fun thing that we decided to do forever.
Absolutely.
That's fine.
Hi, everybody.
It's probably fine. Hello, everyone.
It's fine. My name is David Bell.
My name is Tom Ryman.
And we just watched The Long Goodbye.
The Long Goodbye. Or how
it's a song.
That kind of how it goes? They play it. It's the only song that exists in this universe.
And it's the only lyric. It's just like, cause, oh, every time it cuts some prick and they're like, The Long Goodbye. And I'm like, what more? Is that the chorus?
Meet Philip Marlowe.
Marlowe?
Your name, Marlowe?
You shouldn't be out of bed, Mr. Marlowe.
I'm not Mr. Marlowe. This is Mr. Marlowe right here.
Well, who are you?
You're Philip Marlowe.
Are you crazy?
Yeah.
Elliot Gould is Philip Marlowe in Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye.
Is it the whole song? Do you just repeat that? Come on.
It's like a jingle, you know. It's a commercial. It's only 8 seconds
long. For long goodbyes.
Yeah.
What is a long goodbye? Is it just saying goodbye?
It's a very slow hand job.
Oh, that is, yeah, I should have known. God,
just
I should have
real
known.
Methodical, like a surgical hand job.
Yeah. What are we doing?
I don't know.
We are, okay, listen. Big old thank you to Ombre. Thank you, Ombre.
Thank you.
So much for having us watch the Elliot Gould, Robert Altman
1973
detective.
Satirical noir film.
Yes, it's a comedy noir. Ombre, thank you so much for all your support.
Yes, genuinely thank you. And genuinely thank you for selecting this movie for us to watch, because I hadn't seen this before. And
neither had I.
And Dave, this is a treat.
So this is Robert Altman, who made The Gosford Park, the screenwriter, Lee Brackett, who wrote Empire Strikes Back.
Empire Strike Back. Yes, she wrote one draft of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it is it's listed as comedy crime drama on the IMDb's.
On the IMDb's?
And yeah, I had never seen it before either. It's an LA noir.
You know,
what did you
like
think
the
of
game.
It, Tom?
I really liked it, man. I loved this movie.
It was a delight. It was a delight.
It's so Shane Black. Like, I mean, of course it is. It's based on a Raymond Chandler novel. And if you don't know who that is, he was a big time. He basically invented single-handedly, but he had a big part in inventing like the idea of the PI, the cool gumshoe, the private investigator, like the big sleep is a Raymond Chandler book. Like Humphrey Bogart played Philip Marlowe in another movie. So I really liked this movie. And yeah, you really can tell that like Shane Black is into all that old like Raymond Chandler stuff. Like he incorporates it a lot.
Yes.
So you just get such like this is the exact vibe of a Shane Black movie.
Yes. That was my thought as well, which I was like, oh, this is where he gets it from.
Yeah.
Because it's a combination of a few things. Very efficient storytelling, scumbag main character.
But not really. Like he's got a pretty firm moral code.
Oh, yeah. And we'll talk about that. And then the chaos, the comedic chaos, like the idea that anything could just throw a wrench in your plans.
It is a little it's also a little Big Lebowski because of
yes.
that.
Yes. And then there's the cordial relationship between like the villains and the good guy. The Shane Blackness comes out there, you know, where there's like. The bad guys
the mobsters
are
being like weirdly patient with him.
Yeah, and everybody's like they're just
his
doing
wife's
business
face with a Coke bottle.
Yeah, yeah. It's this. You get all the vibes of where it's where it all came from.
Clear influence.
Yeah. So Elliot Gould plays Gritty Kramer,
Yeah, Philip. He plays famed private detective Philip Marlowe.
Yes.
But like an updated version. I thought this was interesting because Philip Marlowe was written, obviously, it for like the 30s and 40s. So he's right. A bygone era. Private investigators in the 30s and 40s are very different from what you think when somebody says private investigator in, say, 1973 when this movie was made.
Yeah, and
it was always kind of like they glamorized it in the old like Bogart films where it's kind of like, yeah, he's sort of like Batman. Like he's outside the law. He's not really a cop, but he's, you know, like anyway, but it became like a real sleazy profession.
Yeah. And
it's interesting that they bumped it up to that era where it's very sleazy. I mean, it was always a little sleazy, but it's like pure sleaze in this era.
Yeah, he's like a lovable dirtbag. Yeah. Like he wakes up to his cat screeching at him at 3 a.m.
I think with a cigarette in his mouth, right? Doesn't he have a smashed cigarette in his mouth?
I imagine so, yes. Yeah, he never is without a cigarette.
You're right. He's never not smoking, and I think he's the only person that smokes.
Yeah, he might be.
I think he's like the movie does a neat thing with the advancing the character to 1973 where it seems like he's out of time a little bit.
Yeah.
Not entirely because he is still Elliot Gould, but he's Elliot Gould playing this type of character who seems like he came from a bygone era.
Oh yeah, he's like he's kind of has that weird gentlemanly like, you know, I'm not bothering anybody. Like he plays it real passive, and I want to talk about that specifically because that's I think part of his character is he kind of like it's, you said Lebowski-ing it.
Yeah,
a little bit.
It's part of the PI thing in noir. Like if you read a lot, or like you'd be surprised at how like little Bogart does in like The Maltese Falcon, or so, you know, like right. How passive the detective often is in these movies.
It's this feeling like he's very strategic, so he doesn't do a lot, but when he does, it matters.
Yeah,
and so he's sort of hanging back, and like, yeah, he's also again, they do a very Lebowski thing, him getting up to his cat, and he wanders out to go get his cat's favorite cat food, because this cat's being a real dirtbag, just screeching
cat,
at him.
Yeah.
And he goes to the grocery store and he runs into the guy there and the guy just demolishes him with who needs a cat? I got a girl.
I love that he sees him again later in lockup. They're like, hey, yeah. Hey,
how's your cat? Yeah.
How's your cat? Yeah, it's fine. How's your girl? Yeah.
Yeah. He's like fists this can of cat food. He's like just using his hands to dig it out. We meet his neighbors who just never not have their tits out.
Yeah, they're all doing hot yoga.
That's like their defining quality. Yeah, they represent new age hippies,
and
right?
Not hot yoga in the actual sense. Hot like they're hot and they're doing yoga.
Yes, like there's a scene the next day. One of the neighbors is wearing a bathing suit and still has her boobs out. Like, and it's like, how did you even manage to do that?
Right, like, yeah, it was like a riddle.
Yeah, yeah. Their defining quality is that they're just
like a magic
hot
guy.
Chicks
it was
who
like,
are
wait,
naked.
Am I seeing what I'm seeing?
Right. And there's this vibe of like they represent the kids and he's never like perving on them. He's just sort of like, those crazy
kids next door. It really does hammer home the idea. It's the constantly hitting the idea of he's out of time. Like,
yeah,
he's
a dinosaur.
He's a dinosaur. He's an old man. And like, he's so far from being like a sexual object to them, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, he's like grandpa.
Yeah.
You know,
like, so it's just like, it's never anything but this perfectly genial relationship. And then it's so funny when like the bad guys will come over and they're all just like gawking at the women constantly, right. Which actually works to his advantage later.
It does.
That guy, Harry,
also,
I love that guy.
Oh, yeah. It also gives the vibes that they're a little also out of time, just a little bit, because they don't understand the new age stuff either, where he's like, I think they're doing witchcraft or whatever.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Like, yeah, it's yoga. And they're like, what's yoga? And he's like, I don't know, but that's it.
We're still playing gangsters. Know? Yeah. But like,
yeah,
but it's 1973. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Things have moved on.
He also has another defining quality is that he constantly talks to himself. And I realize that's because he's doing VO. He's doing noir detective.
He's doing the
VO.
Noir narration, yeah.
Yeah, but he's doing it out loud.
Right.
He's not actually, there's not actually a VO. The bit is that he kind of walks around and just jabbers to himself.
Mutteringly narrates his life, and it's perfect. It's such a fun decision. There's
it
also
really
a lot
is.
Of, what Altman does, and this is kind of a thing, this is just sort of like an old style, like an old technique that's just not done very often anymore. But Altman likes to do a lot of crosstalk, and it's effective in mysteries. Like Gosford Park is almost entirely crosstalk.
Because it's easy to miss stuff.
Exactly. It has some people get frustrated with it, which I understand, but the point of it is you're not supposed to catch everything. It's supposed to, you're like in the middle of this conversation, you're getting a bewildering amount of information and you're not sure what's important.
There's actually, so I recently did What Lies Beneath for Inside Dads, and I mentioned this there. There's a really good example in that, which is when Michelle Pfeiffer and Harrison Ford are having dinner with two friends, and they're having cross chatter, and the cross chatter between Harrison Ford and the other teachers about how one of their colleagues got in trouble for stalking a girl. And Harrison Ford's cross chatter is, wow, they don't mess around with that stuff anymore. Mm-hmm. Talking about the schools and not outrage about his friend. And that's a really like cool key cross chatter.
Kind of gives the game away, yeah.
A little bit, but not that much.
Not
enough that I feel like I'm spoiling the movie. But it's like little things like that where it's like you add in these little clues about who these people are in the cross chatter.
It is.
And you might not miss it. Or you might not catch it, rather.
It's not always used in mysteries. Like we recently covered American Graffiti. And then also we did The Fablemans. Oh, not The Fablemans. We did do
Spielberg.
The Fablemans, but I was thinking about something else, but old Spielberg movies do a lot of crosstalk too. And like
Jurassic Park has it a little bit
like Lucas uses it in American Graffiti to basically world build. Like he's just kind of, he gives us all it's crosstalk between a bunch of characters in the beginning. And then we get all the plot devices of the night. Like, oh, we know this character is out to drag race. We know there's a party going on at XYZ. So it's not always used in mysteries, but anyway.
No, it's a way to sort of implant things in the audience subconsciously
or
show, like in Jurassic Park, I feel like it's used at least one time to show like that their interests aren't the same. Like Hammond is talking about the raptor cages when Alan Grant wants to talk about
slowly
the raptors themselves kind of thing, where it's like you show like one character's trying to divert the conversation to one thing while another is diverting
Julian
it to another.
Seabass, I believe. Like he's really trying to, I love it how we're getting off. I just wanted to call it out. I love that it starts with Hammond's conversation in full stereo, and then it slowly lowers out to Grant and Muldoon's conversation.
Because
it's like, oh, it's the sunny thing, and then it's the actual thing. Like, are these fucking animals dangerous? He's like, yeah, they're dangerous.
Yeah.
We should kill them all. Man. I don't know why we have them.
Yeah.
We're never going to put them in a zoo setting.
Yeah, this is a bad idea.
That would be insane.
Why did we make these?
Why
I don't know.
Why are we keeping them? Anyway, so back to this movie.
Yeah. But that's the character. And the setup is he goes out, he gets cat food, he comes home, and his dirtbag friend,
is there.
And his friend has scratches on his face.
What a dirtbag.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's like, I got to get out of here. You got to drive me to Mexico. And he does. And then when he gets home, and there's a lot of the movie is people show up, again, Big Lebowski, and they harass him. They keep dumping things on him.
And he has no idea where they're talking. Like, the cops show up and are bracing him about this guy and this. He doesn't know what they're talking about, really.
It's funny because we mentioned Lebowski, by the way, because Lebowski is a parody of L.A. Noir, right?
Yeah, and so is this to an extent.
That's what's interesting about it is that this is and it isn't. And it feels once you watch this, you're like, oh, it's weird. Like it's Lebowski and like Shane Black. It's not really a parody. It's building off of this because this is like, 70s comedy. So it's not, like they have. One of their sources of comedy is a guy who just does impressions. And I'm like, oh, that's some fucking 70s humor right there, right?
Right, but it ends up...
To their credit, they do a good job. They have a good bit with him.
Yeah, you don't have to know who Walter Brennan is for that bit to work.
Exactly.
Because he's just like holding this mob guy. We are going to tell you that you're going down.
It's pretty great.
What the fuck are you doing?
Right. Yeah, that isn't to say it's not still funny at times, for sure.
Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, you can see. I mean, he does blackface. I mean, he does a smears.
But
it was an Elliot Gould improv I read. It's not really like it's not
in the context of the scene. It's not. He's like in the context. He's been fingerprinted
and
horrible.
He rubs the ink on his face and he's like, "Hey, I'm Al Jolston over here," and he's fucking with the cops.
Right. It's
so it's like you could argue he's making fun.
Yeah,
of it.
It's presented as like the third or fourth thing he does to like. Because he's pissed.
He's antagonizing
them. Yeah, so it's not great, but it's not. I don't know.
Well, it's fitting where it's like they're scummy, and the cops say some pretty homophobic shit to them.
Oh, the cops but are again, awful. Yeah,
and that's kind of the point. It's like, yeah, we don't like the cops.
No, like, they're like, yeah, that's fucking ACAB.
Yeah, that's one of the first. So this is where it comes to efficient storytelling, because what happens is his friend shows up, he drives to Mexico, the cops pick him up, and we have two simultaneous things. The cops give him exposition. They say, your friend was found. Oh, no. No, they're like, your friend is missing. He killed his wife.
He beat her to death. Yeah, and you ran to Mexico. You drove him there.
And so we want to know what you know. And then the cops are very quickly, you can tell, terrible. They're racist, they're homophobic,
they're
but
fascistic.
They're also,
they just like beat him and
exactly,
they hold him in jail for 3 days for nothing.
Like he talks to a guy in the jail and the guy's like, you know, they're just putting people in for weed now. Like it's that idea, which is, it's very funny, but like they keep calling him a cutie pie. They keep calling everything a cutie pie, which was
also
weird, but
that, did you notice that guy was David Carradine?
Oh really?
Yeah.
I did not
notice. The guy in his jail cell.
There is another cameo we'll get
another
into.
Another shocking cameo.
Yeah, there's a moment where you just go, oh, fuck. Yeah.
Holy shit.
But the point is, then the cops, after a few days, they let him out. And they're like, what is this? You're letting me in? We're like, we don't need you anymore. Yeah. Case has been solved.
They also arrest him on a phone. Like, we know immediately. He's like, what are you going to arrest me for? One of them shoves him into the other one. And it's like, oh, you hurt my ear. Like, it's... They fucking suck right from jump.
100%. And then they tell him his friend is dead. He shot himself. And he's like, well, surely you're going to look into it more. And they're like, nah, case closed. And so what this scene does is it gives you the inciting incident and tells you cops won't help.
Mm-hmm.
They are completely useless.
Yeah.
They are fascist. They are dystopian.
They're not interested in the truth. They're just interested in making the case go away.
They're doing RoboCop a little, where they make the police station like this dystopian, like they're just churning criminals through. They don't give a fuck, you know?
Yeah.
It's a mess. It's a lot of very, you know, 70s Death Wish style look at cops, but I happen to kind of agree with it. And in this movie, they're basically just saying like, no one can help you. Like you have to figure this out on your own. The cops don't care anymore.
Right. You are in a world where that is not going to help you.
Right. And so they just say like, yeah, he beat his wife to death and then he shot himself. And that's that. And so this is when he gets a seemingly unrelated case, right? He gets the dame.
Yeah. That's
the dame
that's
walks
a
in.
Classic noir thing, right? It's two seemingly totally unrelated things eventually coming together. And sometimes it's more than two. But yeah, like Lebowski, we keep mentioning.
Yeah, this is definitely. I mean, it is like the ending shot is a little bit of the ending shot of, I believe, The Third Man. Like they're doing.
The twist is The Third Man, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. Spoilers.
Yeah. Sorry.
No. I mean, we're gonna spoil this movie, but yeah.
I know, but
is,
I hope we just spoiled The Third Man for some people too.
It is, I mean, they had plenty of time to see The Third Man. It is very much a take off of that. A shot, like, yeah, and to the point that it's a reverse of the ending shot, The Third Man, which is really cool. But yeah, this dame walks in and it's basically like, I need you to find my husband.
Oh, you're right. It's the car driving away, isn't it?
No, the third, so in the...
Oh, wait.
In the third man, the last shot is he's on the side of the road and she's walking by him. I think it's the third man. And basically she just keeps walking.
That's right. That's right.
It's the shot that Scorsese does. He just straight up pulls that for The Departed.
Mm-hmm.
She does it in that. And it's to show, like, you're dead to me.
Yeah. You know? No longer exist.
And basically they do the similar thing where she drives by him in this and he keeps walking.
Right.
And he doesn't even look at her. So it's like,
it's twofold in that. It's the you're dead to me. And also she knows that he's killed Terry. Terry's probably dead now.
Yeah. Spoilers. And so he finds her husband, which is played by fucking Sterling Hayden.
I know. He's fucking great in this.
I know. I've only seen him play Unhinged Maniacs.
He was going to play Quint.
Yeah, that would have been great. He's the precious bodily fluid.
Precious bodily fluid from Dr. Strangelove. Yeah, he plays. He essentially plays fucking Biff Whiff in this. He plays the shirt brother guy. I think you should leave. He's got a huge crazy beard. He's just a fucking maniac.
Yeah, you'd never know by looking at him that he's the Dr. Strangelove guy. He looks like a fucking Hemingway type. And that's the idea.
I think he's literally supposed to be like a Hemingway stand-in.
Yes, what he's doing would be called doing the Hemingway.
Doing a Hemingway. Yeah, he's drinking himself to death and then he eventually kills himself. He walks into the ocean. He literally walks into the sea, Dave.
That's one of those Shane Black moments to me where it's like there's all these things happening and then in the background, basically, this character just walks into the ocean.
And
it's like, oh, good, we have to deal with this now.
It's such an amazing scene because it starts off as funny. It's a little funny because it's like this drunk old man is wandering into the ocean and they're like, ah, fuck. So you're seeing it play out behind them. So it's a little bit, it's the dramatic irony at first and it's a little bit funny. But then when he and she notice, Sterling Hayden's wife and Elliot Gould notice, they panic and race downstairs. And you suddenly realize it's pitch black out there because it's the middle of the night. They're right on the coast. They're right on the ocean in Santa Monica, I think. And it's just completely black and you realize, oh fuck, those waves are pretty big. Oh fuck, he's really far out there. And it goes on for like several minutes.
Yeah.
And he just gets further and further away into the blackness beyond. And it becomes one of the most haunting things I've seen in a while. And from this scene that started out as like kind of just like this funny, almost like a Woody Allen joke going on in the background.
They also set you up for it because earlier when he's talking to him and they have this, they're having their conversation over drinks, the camera pushes in on the ocean.
It does that a lot.
Then it fades out.
It does that a lot.
And then when he's having a conversation with her, it does the same push in, only there's somebody there. And so we're relaxed. We're used to these push-ins at that point. And then we're like, oh shit, there's a guy there.
He does it throughout the movie too. Like, he'll push in when Marla's on the phone and then he'll pull back out. So it kind of gets you into this, like you're right, it's like a rhythm.
Yeah. It's all about breaking that rhythm.
Yeah.
And then the thing that's Shane Black about it, I think one of the things Shane Black is very good at that other writers try to do, not everybody succeeds. It's something to aspire to do, which is that he does meta humor in a different way. In a way where it's not people calling attention to it. It's taking a trope you've normally seen and taking it to the logical like place, or saying, wouldn't it be funny if blank, right?
Yeah.
And what that often creates is these moments where the plot is completely derailed for something else. Like in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, she slams the door on him and just happens to lop off his finger. And then it's like, well, this is a problem now. Right? Or The Nice Guys, he smashes a window to break in.
It's the same gag.
Cuts his artery. Yeah, and then that's the new plot. The new plot is, oh no, he has to go to the hospital. And so he loves that chaos. I just watched The Predator, and there's that chaos in that. It's not just in his noir stuff.
No, yeah. It's a great way for storytelling too, because it's also a great way to just give you a whole bunch of information about a character.
Yeah, and in this, there's that element, because it's like you introduce like an unhinged character that everybody's sort of like babysitting, And then you have this moment where they go off and fucking die. And you're like, oh, shit, we weren't watching him.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, no one was quite thinking about it, but he was Hemingway. And it was like, of course he's going to fucking walk into the ocean.
Right. Like, they've been treating him like this kind of charming old fool, this comic relief character. And then
right.
suddenly it's like, oh, no, we should have been taking him seriously. Like, it's very real. This is not fun and games for this guy. He is.
And suddenly, yeah. Suddenly the cops are there,
yep.
and
it's suddenly like, he's drowned. Oh,
we have to deal with this.
That's
now.
A funny scene too, when the cops are there, because they've all been, it is implied, because they're all standing. It's clearly hours later. There's boats out there with searchlights, and everybody's just been standing on the beach, drinking and watching the search. So everybody's smashed now.
Yeah. It's incredible.
So yeah, Marlo has to try to get through that scene.
So that's all that is. Basically, he finds this husband for her. He's staying with the guy from the Burbs.
From the Burbs,
who
yeah.
is a very clear red herring, where it's like, well, that guy is ghouling around this clinic. He must be the villain.
He scampers, and he's not really. Dave. He like scampers after Elliot Gould.
Right. And it's another classic, like, I don't know, Shane Black, but also like detective
noir.
Thing where he's just
there's
a dead
always,
end.
There's always a thread. At least one thread that's just a complete dead end. Like, it though this didn't have anything to do with anything.
Yeah, this clinic. What is the clinic?
Like, it's just
with
a
it?
Clinic. Nothing. It's a grifty ass doctor that's fleecing $5,000 from Sterling Hayden, but that's it.
Yeah,
like he's and not involved in anything else. Yeah,
but he looks like a henchman. That's
right,
just
because he's the fucking guy from the Burbs.
Yeah, the one of the he's the doctor, right?
The doctor from the Burbs. Yeah,
yeah. And so. It's that. That's very Shane Black. Again, Shane Black is very this, for the record, obviously,
yeah,
Shane Black. But
precedes him by a decade and a half.
Yeah. And then there's, of course, the relationship with the villain. So he solves this case and then he just sort of befriends the wife because he like clearly this is concerning. And then eventually this guy walks into the sea. He also realizes. So then what happens is a bunch of mobsters show up. Very Lebowski. And this is when the mob guy. Is like a real fucking unhinged maniac is like, where's my money? And he's like, I don't know what money you're talking about.
Right.
It's a lot of money. It's like a quarter of a million
yeah,
or something.
He says,
maybe
he
more.
Says something like 250,000 or 300. I think it's 325,000. It's a fucking lot of money.
It's a lot even for today.
Yeah. And we don't know what he's talking about at
much,
this point.
Yeah.
Like, this is bewildering for us all.
Yeah,
like when Elliot Gould is like, what money? We are like, yeah, what money?
Right. And then they're also kind of looking at the neighbors. And they're like, what's the deal with the neighbors? And this, again, a very Shane Black idea, right? Which is like they're trying to have this moment where they're threatening him, but then they get distracted by something. And suddenly, like Shane Black likes this idea where the social allegiances shift. And suddenly it's all of them looking at the neighbors so, like, yeah, what's the deal with them?
Right. Suddenly they're just like four dudes looking at some hot women.
Exactly, yeah. But it goes back and forth, and these guys are not good guys, and he shows that very clearly by bringing in his girlfriend, talking about how like she was scared, she was startled about something outside, she's like this pure spirit, and then he just smashes her with a Coke bottle. It is brutal and upsetting.
It is.
And that's the idea.
Really intense, man. It is,
yeah,
it is,
and it's
it is
show,
shocking when it happens.
He punishes her for something Elliot Gould is doing.
Yes.
And that's the idea is like, because I think it's good writing because basically the villain knows that he could rough this guy up and he won't care. He will care if he hurts somebody else. That's the basic idea,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then showing it as his girlfriend, he sits down and goes, listen, I want to tell you, I got this house, this suburban life, wife and kids. Again, very Shane Black, which is like, I'm humanizing myself, this mobster. He's just like, no, I got a family. I got people to support. That's why I'm doing this. And so he's just explaining it like a business guy, right? And then he's basically like, yeah, you know, we're going to have to fucking kill you or whatever if you don't get this money. And then they have someone watch him. And Elliot Gould basically has this cordial relationship with this new guy, Harry, who's watching him, because it's that it reminds me of in The Sopranos when the FBI, there's a scene in one of the mid-season, I feel like, where they're outside their little place where they're always talking about crimes, and they know the FBI is always watching them. And there's a scene where two FBI agents come out of the surveillance van, and he's like, I want you to meet our new guy. And they shake hands. They're like, oh, hey, nice to meet you. Like, we'll be working with you. We'll be, this is the new guy. He'll be spying on you.
He says, I'm glad you're the one. I think he tells them, like, I'm honored you're the one following me or something.
Yeah. And he gives him pointers. He's like, what are you doing? What are you bringing? Don't come all the way in. Wait in the car. You know, like, what are you doing? You fucking new guy shit, you know? Which is very fun. And he razzes him a bit because he tells the security guard who does impressions that he loves Walter Brennan.
Yeah.
And even the security guard's like, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm just going in there. There's a guy following me. You can let him in too. Like, it's like, we're all doing shady shit. Don't worry about it. Like, this attitude. Because it's the meta, right? It's a meta gag, which is that this always happens in these movies. So might as well just be upfront about it, right?
Yeah. It's playing with the tropes, like you said.
Yeah.
Instead of, like, looking at the camera and winking.
It's the characters aware of their own tropes, but not calling attention to it.
Right.
And that guy, when he sneaks in, he climbs to the door, and he, like, opens the door, and he's hanging off of it. Because it's like, we've seen a million times a guy jump over a fence. So subvert that, you know?
Yeah, he just hangs there on the gate. Yeah.
Yeah, like an asshole.
And then smashes his fingers.
So, yeah, that's all to say that these mobsters prove to have a connection with this woman and her husband.
Yeah, of course.
And as everything is, all the plot is thickening, the writer clearly seems to know something, right? That's the joke. Is like, he's like kind of interrogating him. He's trying to figure it out.
Yeah, Sterling Payne.
And that's when he walks. Yeah, that's when he walks into the ocean, and it's like, oh. And then that's when he has an interaction again with the mobster, doing "Where's my money?" again. I mean, I'm skipping around because we're not going.
Yeah, we're not doing a play by play of the movie, but it's basically. It's been in the background the whole time, too, which I liked. Basically, we learned that his friend Terry did, in fact, murder his wife, but has faked his death in Mexico.
Yeah, it's a good switcheroo, which is like, oh, no, he did it.
Yeah, no, he totally did it. Like, it's that your first instinct, because he shows up to Marlo's apartment with scratches on his face. And Marlo's like, oh, did you get into it with your wife again? And he kind of touches his scratches and doesn't answer for a second, like he's bewildered. And then he says, yeah. Listen, can you drive me to Mexico? And so I'm watching him get, like, killed his fucking wife.
Right. And, like, they're trying to do that thing where they're like, oh, it's a misdirection.
Right.
But they, like,
it makes it seem like it's a misdirection. Yeah.
It's kind of, so the twist, the meta humor again, is that it's exactly what it always is. And what I mean by that, or it isn't, which is that this dame that walked into his office, inevitably, they're always involved, right? If you've watched enough noir. They're always involved. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, so is she. She has this fucking Doberman that's like constantly vicious, and she's the only one
it
who
only
it
hates
seems
him,
to like.
It seems.
It doesn't seem to like the husband that much.
Oh, that's
either,
true, yeah.
It's just this constant implication of like, clearly there's something sinister about this woman. Like, look at her control over this dog. And dogs are, they keep showing dogs.
When he's so a cat person and his cat runs away and doesn't come back.
Never comes never back. Comes I thought back. They were going to pay that out.
We never see the cat again.
No, it fucks right off. He didn't give it the right food. And it says, all right, fuck you. And leaves. But yeah, and so it's like, you know it's going to be her. But then you don't realize, like, it's so obvious. Like, yeah, he killed his wife. That you're not thinking about it. So it's almost a twist.
Yeah.
In the fact that it's not a twist at all.
Right. And it's just Terry was having an affair with her. Sterling Hayden found out
she had the money, right?
He had the money. He was supposed to drive the money to Mexico for the mobster, and it disappeared.
Right.
And that's why he thinks Elliot Gould knows where it is, because he drove him to Mexico. But
she returns the money.
Yeah, she has the money. Yeah. Now.
And this is where it's like,
and she,
again,
she gets it to the mobster, basically, I assume, to keep him from killing Elliot Gould, because they're like, well, he's our friend and we got him. We'll get him.
She's
off.
Attached to him. Yeah, she's attached to him.
And so is Terry, right? To an extent.
To an extent. So, yeah, it's very Lebowski, too, where it's like,
he just kind of happens. He just kind of gets out of trouble at the end.
Right before he's about to get
his dick cut off.
Yeah, basically all the mobsters get together with him again, and this guy, being unhinged, is like, he brings in his girlfriend whose face he smashed with the bottle, and he says, you know, I apologize to her. I went to her room and I stripped naked, and I said, like, you know, I have no secrets or something like that.
Yeah, nothing.
And he's like, yeah. And he's like, I think we should all do that for her. And so they all strip naked for her and they make Marlo do it. And then they're like, we're going to cut off his dick.
We should mention this, the cameo in the scene. Okay.
Yes. Because what's remarkable is that one of these henchmen is Arnold Schwarzenegger in a mustache.
With a mustache.
Like he's hiding.
He's visibly Arnold Schwarzenegger too. And nobody comments on this.
No, no one's like, oh my God, this man. He's like 25.
Right. Because it's, you know, four
it's
people.
It's his first movie.
It's four people. And then a man who is 2.5 times the size of a normal adult human.
Yes. That's the thing. Even if he wasn't famous today,
right, that's what I mean.
You still watch the scene right. and go,
that's what
like,
I mean
what's
by
that
he's visibly doing? Arnold Schwarzenegger.
It's incredible.
He's not a casual hire for a henchman. You bring that henchman when you're trying to say something very specific.
You don't need other henchmen right. when you have him. And it's shocking because I knew in the back of my head somewhere that Schwarzenegger played a henchman early in his career.
Just his man-at-arms mustache.
Yeah.
It's so good. It's a real
fucking mustache.
It's a real caterpillar.
It is.
Well, not a caterpillar.
And so,
it's a bit bigger than that.
It really sneaks up on you because there's a few shots where I was like, wait, what was that?
Wait, is that
did
a mustache?
I just see?
Right, yeah. It's like the Predator
sheen. Did I just see Arnold Schwarzenegger? Yeah, and I couldn't quite tell. And then there's just like one shot where you see him stripping down. And you're like, oh my God, that is Arnold. My fucking God. What a gift. He doesn't have any lines.
No, he doesn't say anything. And then he just kind of disappears from the movie.
Yeah, then he's gone. Yeah. I don't know why he was there. He's not in the previous
scenes. To spread joy and delight.
So yeah, that completely derailed the movie for me. There's a little Into the Mr. Universe episode with Arnold and his mustache. It's like a brown mustache. It's like, man, it's like a dad mustache.
It's shocking.
It's like an 80s
dad. Shocking.
Yeah. And it doesn't fit him. Like, that's the thing, it looks like it was put on him.
Yeah. It looks like somebody else's mustache.
Yeah,
it looks like he jumped. You know how they jump the guard and steal their clothes? It looks like he jumped the guard and stole his mustache.
Yes. I wonder if it was like, Arnold, you got this part playing like a mobster henchman, and they're like wise guys. So think about that. And it's like, okay, well, I'm a giant Austrian man. I'm not exactly a wise guy. Maybe if I make a mustache, get a mustache going, that'll make me look more like a mobster. That's the most sense I can make his mustache. Is haunting.
It's a real special moment.
Yeah. But yeah, he gives them $5,000 because that's all he has. He has a $5,000 bill on him. And the mobsters, again, being very cordial, they then leave the room, they get a call, and then they come back in. Or like he walks out and he's like, I'm going to go. And they're like, yeah, here's your $5,000. Sorry. Because they got the money back. So they're just like, you're done. We're sorry about all that. Here's your money back.
Yeah,
like
your $5,000 bill, which I didn't even know was a thing. I thought he was being punked.
No, apparently it was. So like, again, it's like they're monsters, but they're logical, you know?
Yeah.
And this is when I believe he sees the woman in her car, Miss Wade, and chases after her and gets nailed by another car, which
sure
is another
does.
Shane Black idea. Because then he wakes up in the hospital and it's like, okay, now I have to deal with this.
Yep, next to a guy in a full body cast who hands him a tiny harmonica.
For no reason.
No reason. What is this?
And he's like,
oh,
thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he tells the nurse, like, take care of this guy. He's important. And then he goes to Mexico because he's starting to figure some stuff out. He's already gone to Mexico once to investigate his friend's death. And talk to the authorities there who just said, like, yeah, he went up into his room. He shot himself.
And they show him some photos of his dead body on ice.
Yeah. And this time he comes
back. And we see
his
hog. We see a hog. There's a hog in this movie.
There's a hog.
We see Terry's hog.
Yeah. We see his mad hog. His dead
hog. His
dead hog.
But not really dead because the photos were staged, Dave.
Right.
He bribed the Mexican cops.
Yep. And the Mexican cops being bribable, he basically, Elliot Gould bribes them again. And they're like, oh, yeah, it was all faked. Here's where he is.
Yeah, they just drive him to where he is. he gives him the $5,000 bill.
Yes.
In point of fact.
And so all of this time we've had a detective who he's been Lebowski-ing. He's just sort of passive. Like nothing's really, he's just thrown into this adventure. He's going with the flow. He's very casual in every scene. Even he's like smoking cigarettes, always a little drunk. Like he's doesn't make waves, you know, when, he's very passive. He's not a tough guy. Right.
Right.
You would say that about him.
I would agree. Yeah.
There's a strength in his character because of that. Like he has nothing to prove. And that's always the people who are the most strong.
Right.
And so you get that vibe from him.
Oh, there's a couple of scenes where they try to provoke him into a fight or make him like try to get him to sweat. And it just doesn't work. Like that's where the strength comes out.
Yeah, and I've known people like this where it's like people who've spent a lot of time fighting in the past sort of know at a certain point, like, you know, you don't have anything to prove. Sometimes the best way to win a fight is to not get in the fight, right? Is to like apologize or to disengage, you know, where it's like sometimes it's not worth it, you know? And he's very much that, where it's like he's choosing his battles very precisely. And he is very passive. And that's all to say he goes to his friend. His friend is in the pool and he confronts him basically. And his friend is very casual. Like, yeah, I beat her to death. You know? Yeah, we used you. That's what friends are for.
Yeah.
And you know, like
he was totally going to let that mobster kill him.
Yeah.
It seems
his friend
maybe
just threw him under the bus.
Yeah.
And I think this woman who cared about him helped was the only reason.
Yeah, you're right. I think it was probably totally her. And not any at all, Terry. Terry did send him the $5,000 bill.
Right. There's also a part this reminded me of the game or a lot of things where after he wakes up in the hospital, he goes to her house and she's gone. She's moved out. There's a realtor there.
Yeah.
So like she's fucking, so he puts two and two together there basically. And so he's just, what is the line? He says something like,
I lost
you're
my
a born
cat.
Loser.
Oh yeah, he says, yeah, you're a born loser. Yeah.
He's like, yeah, I lost my cat, and just shoots his friend dead.
Yep.
And it's the only time he does something, and it's the most extreme thing. He commits a murder.
Yeah.
A cold-blooded murder. He just shoots this unarmed guy. He just shoots him and he dies. And then he walks down the road passing the Mrs. Wade.
Playing his harmonica.
Playing the new harmonica.
Tiny harmonica, yeah.
She slows down. He doesn't even fucking recognize he doesn't acknowledge her. And then the movie ends. And it's a very satisfying ending there.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, because it's basically him going like, fuck you.
I liked how subtle it was too. So when her name, I forget what her name was, Mrs.
It's something Wade.
Eileen, I think.
I think you're right.
So when she first shows up, she's got like, she has like a visible bruises on her face and what's his nuts? Marlo. Sorry. I couldn't remember the character's name. Elliot Gould. It's like, look, I'm going to just skip being tactful. I don't think you bumped into a door.
Right.
And then she says, oh, well, Sterling Hayden, he beats me. But we see later that that's not the case.
Yes.
And it's actually Terry who's the person that has a violent temper because he beats his wife to death. So it's like that's kind of a real, I took that as a real subtle hint of the solution of it's like, oh, it's not Sterling Hayden, it's this is the relation, like she has a secret relationship with Terry and they're stealing this mobster's money and running away to Mexico.
Connection. What was the connection between, because like it feels like a jump to connect his friend with her,
they live in the same neighborhood,
and didn't Sterling like sleep with the dead wife or something like that?
It's implied, but the reveal is that it was the opposite. Like that's what she claims. That's what Eileen tells Marlo,
right.
But Marlo finds out later that it was actually the opposite, is she was sleeping with Terry. Sylvia, Terry's wife, found out. And I think Sterling Hayden found out too. So anyway, Terry beats his wife to death because she found out.
It works out really well because it's like it's a leap, but it isn't, right? Because it makes sense. And it, like, for example, we talk about the coincidence of her coming to him. It's not a coincidence.
It's not a coincidence.
Like she specifically went to him because they were using him. Shit like that, where it's like, he puts it all together and realizes, like, logically speaking, these two are together. And yeah. that means that he's not dead. And that means that he faked his death, which means that he's still in Mexico. And so it's very satisfying as a conclusion, because it feels like a leap, but then it isn't when you think about it.
No, it's all more logical.
Than a second. Yeah. So yeah, it's man, in terms of like LA noir, it's
really satisfying. It's a really satisfying little comedy noir mystery. Even, you know, with a little bit of blackface in it. even so.
I love us saying, like, little bit well, it's funny because there's a black cop who then calls him, like, a honky bastard.
No, but I think he's talking about the lieutenant in that scene.
He's talking about the lieutenant. About the lieutenant. You're right.
Yeah, because lieutenant's being a real motherfucker in that scene. Yeah. And yeah, just, man, just a geyser of homophobic slurs from that guy.
Yeah, from the cop again.
Yeah, the cop.
Not
the
our
cops,
main character.
Yeah, the cops really suck in this movie.
Yeah, they make like a commentary about shitty weed laws, where he's like, can you believe they're going after weed?
Yeah.
You know, like.
Fucking David Carradine.
yeah. There's this, yeah, they're dealing with this idea of like these old-timey people kind of clashing with 70s New Age, a world they don't fully understand. And so I think that's when it comes into the noirness of like the meta noir. And much like Shane Black, it's a very subtle meta noir where the characters don't fit in the world, but they're also humans. Like we were getting into a time where people in movies were human. And what I mean by that is when you go back and watch an old Bogart film, everybody's not quite a human. Everybody's kind of a character.
No, it's very it's still very theatrical. And by that, I mean like stage acting.
And everybody always
still,
says the right
still
thing.
A lot of that
all the perfect things always used to happen. And this is when we started getting into the exploring of like, what if we human error comes in? What if people are people, you know, what if this mobster guy is just horny?
American cinema, to be clear.
Yeah. And so that's why it's like, and I think this comes in waves, right? And so like I think of a movie like Being There, kind of in the same vein as this, which is also a 70s comedy, which is about this man kind of like failing his way up just because he's a white guy in a suit. Like that's kind of it, where it's like he's a white guy in a suit.
There.
Everybody just assumes he's important to the point that he becomes president, at least implied by the end. And so it's like these satires of the idea of like in movies, people will just say things and then we know we know what they mean. But it's like how no one says goodbye on the phone, you know,
right? They just hang up like, in movies.
There's a good example of that in of all movies, Formula 51, where the inciting incident is they are like driving this guy from the airport and they are going to pamper him. And one of them says to the other, like, yeah, go take care of him. And then the other guy kills him. And he's like, take care of him. You said take care of him. And he's like, I meant like literally just see to him. And it's like that becomes a major issue. And it's shit like that, right? Take care of him is a classic mob thing to say in movies. And everybody knows what that means. But in reality, if my boss said, hey, take care of that guy, I'd be like, I would ask like five times, like, you mean kill him, right? Because I can't undo
just
that.
Just to be clear that we're on the same page.
Yeah, I don't want to mess
care
this
of
up.
Him.
And that's what this is taking advantage of, is like it's entering out of the noir genre and like playing with those things we just accepted, which is always a fucking delight.
It's
a really good noir.
Yeah, it's playing with tropes, like we said. I don't have anything else to say. This movie was a delight.
Yeah, I just can't stress enough that I kept thinking Gritty Kramer. Like, he just looked like Gritty Kramer throughout. Did you get that? Like, I just kept seeing Detective Cosmo Kramer.
Yeah. No, but now that you mention it, now that's all I will see.
Yeah.
I kept thinking about that tweet about that TV Guide cover that Elliot Gould was on with Grover.
Oh, real fucking sexy.
Sexy like you
asked. The sexy Grover Elliot Gould picture. Yeah.
His shirtless Elliot Gould in overalls, holding cradling Grover in his manly arms.
Yeah, Go look that up, folks. Go look up that fucking picture. It's great. All right.
Let's be done.
Well, thanks, Ombre.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, this was a delight. I hadn't seen it. I'm glad I saw it. Positive experience all around. This was done through our Patreon, patreon.com/gamefullyunemployed, GAMEFULLY, unemployed. We watch movies every Friday night with our patrons. That's a big fun thing. We also do custom We Just Watched. That's what this is. We also just have like a $5 tier where you get access to a bunch of exclusive podcasts, such as Tom and Jeff Watch Batman, Fox Mulder's A Maniac, Star Trek The Next Futurama, and Spiel Boys. So just go check it out. Look around. See what's what. If you
dabble,
like anything.
Dabble. Browse. See what catches your eye. Yeah. We also have a store. Head over to gamefullyunemployed.com. Excuse me. We will find the link to our Teespring store. We have all kinds of cool original artwork and designs you can get on t-shirts, mugs, stickers, posters, all sorts of things. So slap your little peepers onto that.
Your screechy little cat peepers.
Little cat very peepers.
Very good cat depiction. Very good representation of cat.
What was it? He kept saying screeching it. What was it called? Like Coosie brand or Kate? He kept saying
the cat's basically, he tries to feed the cat like dirt bag food, like cottage cheese and eggs. And the cat's like, no. And he goes out and gets some, like a shitty
cat
brand
food. But
food,
it's the wrong brand. Yeah.
Tries to do a switcheroo. And the cat's like, no. It runs away. And it's like, this is, yep. You have represented the cat
owning a cat.
Just a wild animal screaming at you.
Yeah, it's like Chewbacca.
Yeah, little Chewbacca.
Chewbacca's little Chewies, little co-pilots.
Aw. Hey, listen, our music is produced by Chris Corlew. You can find him on twitter.com as the Corlew, or go to shipwreckedsailor.bandcamp.com. Our channel artwork is produced by Michael Vincent Bramley. For more of his work, go to mvbramley.art. Our episode artwork is by Justin Brown, available on Twitter as Justin T. Brown or at artnessbyjustinbrown.com. And finally, additional artwork is by Starlene Hodge. You can find her work at starlenearts.com or on Twitter as StarleneX. Cool. Goodbye.